So we are on the third now of the Brahma Viharas. Seems to have gone so fast. We could spend a whole week on just one of those. So we're on mudita, empathetic joy, which I confess to having a very special fondness for because it also happens to be the name of one of my kitties, Mudita. We call her Mooney. And my second cat actually is named Sukha, which means bliss. So they both bring me joy and bliss, great joy and bliss. And I find it interesting that of all the Brahma Viharas, I think for as many years as I've been practicing, there's a lot of emphasis on kindness and compassion and equanimity. I don't hear a whole lot about mudita. There's not a lot of, even when I went looking for talks about it, kind of as a research, I couldn't find a whole lot of talks on mudita. And I think there's a reason for this. It's because in the West, I think this is really hard one, a really hard one for us, mudita. And if we can recall again the truth that our beliefs and our perceptions are conditioned based on what we're swimming in, our upbringing, our culture, all the rest, we might recognize that as Westerners, we are very much conditioned to have strong beliefs about the importance of the individual as opposed to the group. Would you all agree that that's true in the Western culture, right? So what the teachings show us is that actually what causes us so much pain is the fact that this idea of separation, this is our greatest source of suffering, is the sense of being separate. So if you look at our Western culture, which emphasizes the individual, you can see how much, start to see how much stress and pain that causes us. So just as an example, my husband was reading a book, I think about depression, that's out recently. And in it, he found this study that I found fascinating. Researchers took this picture of a crowd of little girls. And there was one little girl in the crowd who was just grinning ear to ear, just smiling broadly. And the other little girls in the group with her were all sad. They all were frowning, kind of. And so researchers showed the photograph to some Western children and asked if they thought if she was happy. Is this little girl happy? And they all said yes. Of course, she, look at her, she's happy, right? And they showed the same exact photo to a group of children from Asia, and they all said that no, she was sad. Isn't that interesting? So why is this? So the researcher said that the Western children have no problem isolating an individual from a group, whereas Asian children took it for granted that if the girl was surrounded by distress, that she would be distressed too. Just found that so fascinating as a way of looking at our perceptions, seeing that it's simply, you know, question our beliefs. It's the water we're swimming in, and we don't even see it. And as the teachings tell us, our sense of being separate is an illusion, you know, and the happiness of others really affects us, and our happiness affects others. That's the truth. So why, you know, this is why the practice of mudita is so important. It's both a wish for our own and others' happiness and an attunement with the happiness of others. It's a connection. It's an attunement. So you might also recall that mudita, just like all the other Brahma Viharas, grows out of the soil, the foundation of metta, the first Brahma Vihara, and that it is essentially what goodwill or metta feels when it encounters happiness and goodness. Okay? It's what metta feels when it encounters happiness and goodness. It wants the happiness and the goodness to continue. So if you remember compassion, when metta meets sadness, it wants the suffering to end, right? So when we're experiencing empathetic joy, our hearts are resonating, attuning with the happiness and the good hearts of other people. It's resonating. So we're in essence rejoicing that our wish for others' happiness is actually coming to fruition, right? That was our wish, and now we've gotten our wish. We see that others are we're witnessing others' joy and actually feeling it in our own hearts. So it's also what we feel when we simply wish for others to be happy, even if that wish will never come true, right? That's what we feel in our hearts with just that aspiration, that wish that others are happy. That's what's resonating. That's what we're nurturing in our hearts. So with mudita, it's our wish or aspiration that's important for our practice. And the reason for this is that our wish can help dissolve our sense of being separate, along with our sense of aversion and hatred and greed and ill will. That's what we're trying to conquer, really, with all of these Brahma Viharas, is why we practice these. So think about what happens to our hearts and minds, for instance, when we have the opposite wish. Just think about it. If you want to think about what happens when we have that wish for others' happiness, think about what happens to the heart when we have the opposite wish, when we're feeling hatred or aversion or, you know, towards others, or maybe when we wish for them to suffer in some way, right? I want to see that person in orange in jail, locked up with his hands behind his, you know, his back. You know, that's a wish for other suffering. And this toxic state of mind and heart is exactly what we're trying to counter by cultivating our wish for our own and others' happiness. In the famous Metta Sutta, the Buddha's prayer, it includes this. I'll read it to you. Happy at rest, may all beings be happy at heart. He didn't say some beings. Just want to point that out. May all beings be happy at heart. Whatever beings there may be, weak or strong, without exception, long, large, middling, short, subtle, blatant, seen and unseen, near and far, born and seeking birth, may all beings be happy at heart. Let no one deceive another or despise anyone anywhere, or through anger or irritation, wish for another to suffer. That's a really tall order, isn't it? Right? So he's asking us to wish for the happiness of all beings without exception, and to not despise anyone, including ourselves. Including ourselves. And of course, it's that without exception part that's the most difficult, right? And, you know, so for instance, it might be really easy for us to wish happiness for our pets or our children or our loved ones. In fact, we might automatically do this kind of unconsciously, right? We just might automatically, I want my pets, my loved ones, my, you know, significant others to be happy. But what about ourselves? Just think about it. Is that automatic? Is it? To think about. And what about all those beings who we think should really be on the receiving end of suffering, right? How often do we wish for their happiness? How often do we do that, right? So what the Buddha is urging us to do is to not only wish for their happiness, but to do this often, to make it a very consistent practice. And the reason for this is that if someone truly knows the causes of happiness and are happy themselves, they are going to be much less likely to cause themselves and others so much harm, aren't they? If they're happy. So again, their happiness, the happiness of others, truly does really affect us. I want that person to know the causes of happiness so that they'll stop doing so much harm. So just for a moment, you might think about anyone in your life who has caused harm. Just someone that you know that's close to you or you know of that's caused harm. Haven't they done that out of a sense of unhappiness of some sort? Right? So what about, you know, maybe all those people out in the world who have caused harm? Of our leaders? Yeah. Aren't they acting out of some sense of greed, aversion, hatred, or delusion? You know, the poisons. And when we ourselves do ourselves or others harm, aren't we also, whenever you do harm to someone, think about this. With no judgment, it's just a noticing. Because I know when I do it, I kind of look at, when I do harm, what am I acting out of? Oh, that was greed, or that was aversion, or that was some kind of delusion, some sort of propping up, my need to prop up myself, protect myself, right? So when we're acting out of one or more of what are called the three poisons in practice, which are greed, hatred, and delusion, it's actually really not bringing any of us any kind of happiness, yourself or others, is it? When we're acting out of that. Though sometimes it might masquerade as this, you know. Sometimes when we're greedy and we go and do something and we initially get what we want, you know. But in reality, it's actually a really painful place to live, and it's definitely not the bliss states. Something else. And by the way, the Buddha is not telling us that we can only be happy when everyone else is happy. That's not really what he's saying. He is asking us to be happy, to cultivate limitless joy within ourselves, and to share that, to not keep it to ourselves, okay? And to wish for the happiness of all beings. The Dalai Lama, in fact, has suggested that the practice of wishing happiness for everyone, not just ourselves, just makes logical sense. He says, if I'm only happy for myself, many fewer chances for happiness. If I am happy when good things happen to other people, billions more chances to be happy. So it's logical. And so, you know, the instructions are pretty clear in the suttas, aren't they? And yet, why are they so hard? Why is it so difficult sometimes? So there's many reasons for this. And one of the first is that even though we can intellectually we say, okay, I get it. You know, these practices, if I really did them the way that they're laid out and spelled out in the directions and the instructions, these would lead to more joy and happiness. One of the reasons that there's a problem in this is that we tend to somehow feel like it's a selfish thing to be happy in this culture. Especially when maybe others around us are really struggling or suffering, or people in the world are suffering, and there's so much stuff going on in the world. How can I possibly allow myself to experience any sense of joy? Right? We might even experience a sense of guilt about this, right? And maybe see a belief that might look like, I shouldn't be happy when others are suffering. I shouldn't be feeling happy when X, Y, and Z, fill in the blank. I shouldn't. And I think many of you know what I say about the shoulds, right? Whenever you catch a should in your mind, you see it, and it's a should. It's toxic, right? So don't should all over yourself. That's my message to you. So really, it's true, though. We can really get into a big case of the shoulds here. With, I can't be happy because X, Y, and Z, fill in the blank. Or it might feel like, you know, sometimes like we're sticking our head in the sand. You know, what are you happy about? There's so much stuff going on right now. You know, it can feel like, you know, a naivete or sticking your head in the sand. Or maybe for some of us, it might feel a little too kumbaya, you know, and all of those things. But it's really important to remember that our wish or aspiration for all beings to be happy and to know the causes of happiness needs to include ourselves. As with all the other Brahmaviharas, you know, sometimes it's so easy to, you know, I can offer kindness to that person and I can offer compassion to that other person, all these people. But then when it comes to ourselves, we have a harder time. So mudita practice, sympathetic joy, also has to include wishing yourself happiness and in enjoying your own joy when you're happy, and to not squash it like I shouldn't. Enjoy your joy. Don't squash it. And this is, again, it's really important. It's not selfish. Because, again, when we're happy, we're going to be much less likely to be filled with hate or greed or delusion. And we're therefore less likely to cause harm when we're feeling joyful. Okay? And also, you know, our happiness is actually truly needed and it needs to be shared. The world really needs more people who can offer joy, especially in the face of great suffering. You know, we need that smile. Don't we? When you're really suffering, don't you need that person that's just going to come and smile? Not a covering over. Just being there and offering some joy. One of my favorite nuns, I've said many times before, is Pema Chodron. And she tells us, times are difficult globally. Awakening is no longer a luxury or an ideal. It is becoming critical. We don't need to add any more depression, more discouragement, or more anger to what's already here. It's becoming essential that we learn how to relate sanely with difficult times. The earth seems to be beseeching us to connect with joy and discover our innermost essence. This is the best way that we can benefit others. It's the best way we can benefit others. In a very similar way, the Buddha tells us, overcome your uncertainties and free yourself from dwelling on sorrow. When you delight in existence, you will awaken and become a guide to those in need, revealing the path to many. Okay. So your practice is needed. Your happiness is needed. Some of you may know that I have a practice of saving very short, memorable quotes, like this is it, this too, all of those, and writing them down. I write them down on sticky notes. So when I see them around my house, it'll remind me of the teachings. Really good practice. Anybody do that? Put sticky notes? I'm encouraging it. Yeah, some people are raising your hands. Okay, good. My students. And one of my favorites is from the Zen master Thich Nhat Hanh, who just tells us, suffering is not enough. Isn't that great? Suffering is not enough. That's one of my sticky notes, right? So when I go into the bathroom and I'm like, God damn it, after, you know, looking at the computer screen at yet another thing, you know, suffering is not enough. So besides Thich Nhat Hanh, maybe one of our greatest living examples of what the consistent practice of mudita can do is the Dalai Lama. And he's such a beautiful embodiment of the Brahma Viharas. And he really lives in them, despite so many atrocities in his lifetime that he's seen, right? The Dalai Lama. And people all over the world, every time they see the Dalai Lama, he's either laughing or smiling, right? And whenever anyone asks him if he's happy, without hesitation, he always says, yes. Yes, I'm happy. And he actually calls himself a professional laugher. And I love that the Buddha himself was often referred to as the happy one. He was referred to as the happy one, even though in so many depictions of him, he often looks so serious and grim and kind of has a poker face on him. And, you know, I had a meditation once. I think I was leading the retreat, and I just had this incredible sense of the Buddha smiling, like huge grin. It was just one of the best sits I can remember. And it reminded me of just the Buddha is not a serious dude. He's so loving and happy, the happy one. And of course, being joyful does not at all mean that we are ignoring the great measure of suffering in our world. It's not that at all. Or that we avoid taking responsibility for alleviating as much of the suffering as we can. Okay? It's not a covering over. You know, we're not painting a smiley face on suffering. Oh, it's okay. Everything's good. Let's just be happy. Everything's fine. It's not that. The teachings actually ask us to open up to all of it, to open up to, be awake to suffering and joy, all the waves, so that we're awake fully to those waves. So I like to think of it as like an ocean. I think I mentioned this in the groups today. It's like we welcome those waves of joy when it comes, like we're the ocean. Ooh, here's a joy wave. Here's a rainbow. Holy cow, that's a double rainbow, you know? Wow. And we just ride it. Woo, that was awesome. Knowing that it's going to go. It's dark out now, right? It went. Everything like that. But we open to it. What we don't want to open to is like, woohoo, here's a grief wave. Woohoo, you know? That's not what we do we? We just say, oh, God, here it comes. I really don't want it. Oh, God, I want it to go away. Please make it stop. And what happens when we do that, when we resist, rather than go, whew, here's that wave. All right, let me feel this. Let me feel this fully. I'm going to feel my human emotion of grief or anger or whatever it is, right? What do? I don't want to make it go away. How do I make it go away? And we freak out. And what happens is that it locks it in. We become an ice cube rather than the flow of the ocean. And then it just locks that emotion in. And it, guess what? It takes so much longer to thaw out if we don't ride that wave fully. So open up to it, you know? That's what brings joy. Because isn't it a relief? Honestly, if you think about it, when you can feel your anger and not act out on it, doesn't it feel good? It's a rush. Woo, you know? And it goes. Or when you can feel the tears of grief, and then it goes. It's a relief, always, always. But only if we open up to it and not struggle against it. So the other part of it is, when we're practicing aversion and not wanting, and practicing being that ice cube, I don't want it, I don't want the suffering. When we're blocking out the suffering, guess what? We're blocking out the joy. Okay, we're blocking it out. Our hearts can't just kind of go back and forth that way. It also, when they tighten, it's blocking out the joy. That's for encouragement. Okay, you want the joy, you got to open up to the other stuff as well. And the more we can practice in this way, the more we can recognize that life itself, ourselves included, all of it is a constant flow. It's a constant wave of experience. And our happiness does not come from external sources, since these are always shifting and they're completely out of our control. Really, life is out of our control. We can't will the rainbow, you know? It comes. The great monk and scholar Tanisaro Bhikkhu tells us, it's not that other people don't behave in evil, outrageous, horrible ways. There are people like that in the world. But if your peace of mind were totally dependent on everyone else's behaving themselves, you would be their slave. You'd never get free. But as the Buddha said, the whole issue of suffering is something we can overcome through our own efforts. This means that we have to look at the suffering we create for ourselves. Yeah. So as the teachings show us, our happiness is actually built, our more sustained happiness is actually built by very consciously working on this practice, you know, which helps us to clearly recognize the mind states and actions that lead to happiness and the mind states and actions that lead to suffering. That's our practice, noticing what beliefs and thoughts and habits of mind create suffering and what brings joy. Yeah. That can be real simple, actually. At my own Sangha in Winchester, Virginia, how many of you are here? Raise your hand, my Sangha members. Yeah, okay. So at my own Sangha in Winchester, which is about an hour and a half or so north of here, every week we start with, it's about 30, 40 people, and we start with a practice that is, it's a community practice as a way to gladden or brighten the mind, as Pat was talking about, which is the practice of mudita, and it's a way to prepare the atmosphere of the mind for meditation. So I want to encourage you all, when you sit, to maybe practice this. And what we do is we go around the room one by one, and each person just shares one joy from the day or the week. And we're asked to ride the wave, let that circle just kind of build it up, so that we're riding the wave of each person's joy. You know, and each person, it's really kind of fabulous. Every time it ends, I want it to go again, because you just get kind of a buzz around it. It's like, this was so beautiful, and I had this, and I had this. And, you know, we did another practice a while ago that was, we would do a joy and a sorrow, and it didn't work. But the beauty of that was that there were both. The truth that there's both. And what do we usually focus on? We focus on the sorrow. So it was a way to focus on the joy. But now we just do the joy. But the beauty of it is at the end, when we're all finished, everyone's beaming, because we've just really built up that mudita. Okay. And we're also feeling very connected as a sangha, a community in communion, in union, and we feel not separate. And you might have gotten a little bit of a taste of that, maybe by watching that rainbow. Yeah? Just feel connected? I know I did. I felt connected to the Sangha here, because we were all experiencing that joy. And again, feeling separate is our deepest wounding. If you think about any of the emotions that you're experiencing, check it out. They all involve some sense, the negative emotions all involve some sense of separateness, right? And the Brahmaviharas and the wholesome emotions, don't they all have a sense of connection? Just start noticing that in your practice, okay? Part of the beauty of mudita practice, I think, is that when we can truly, authentically rejoice in someone else's experience of happiness, what happens is that we actually feel the same thing in ourselves, right? Our hearts attune to other people's joy, and that resonates in our own bodies, hearts, and minds. And the other part of it is, what happens is that we can suddenly get a glimpse of that other person's innate goodness, just a glimpse of it sometimes. And that goodness also resonates in our own good hearts. And even if it's temporarily, just for a moment, the animosity and the ill will tends to kind of fall away, right? When you're experiencing another person's joy. And for instance, you might become aware that the person that you're feeling animosity towards maybe loves their children in some way, or their pet, or maybe something beautiful in nature. You know, maybe that person or that roommate that you're like snoring or whatever, and you see them beaming at the rainbow, that might have a little bit of the, you know, aversion kind of fade away. What happens is that it suddenly connects you, and your heart resonates with this. And again, that sense of animosity, aversion, fades away. You might pick it up back up again, but for that moment, it's kind of melted. Choigyam Trungpa Rinpoche, who founded the Tibetan Shambhala tradition, which I was originally trained in, which is why you might notice some of you that my teachings are a mix of Shambhala Buddhism and insight meditation Vipassana. And what he said, I love this, he said, if you are experiencing a lot of aversion or hatred towards someone, you might practice imagining all the things that person might love. That's a practice. Try to imagine that, all the things that person might love, you know. And Choigyam Trungpa said, everyone loves something, even if it's just tortillas. So you might also recall that The definition of mudita includes a sense of empathy, empathetic joy. And Pat was talking about empathy last night. So instead of tuning into someone's pain, with mudita, we are tuning into someone else's sense of joy. Okay? And just as tuning into someone else's pain connects us, so does tuning into someone else's sense of joy. So in both the tears of sorrow and the tears of joy, we can experience that sense of deep connection. Yeah. You ever laughed with someone so hard that you cried? And how that just, you just felt like one? I do that sometimes with my husband when I'm hating him, and he'll make me laugh, you know, and then that's it. I'm done. I don't hate him anymore, you know. And I want to, but he makes me laugh. When I'm mad at him, that's the worst. So, mudita is also about letting go of a strong sense of self. So it's important to remember that it should not be confused with pride. Really important. Because pride invokes a sense of self, doesn't it? Pride. So that's not mudita. Pride is not mudita. If you think about it, pride involves a sense of only I get to ride the waves of this particular person's joy, not other people. It's exclusive. So it's my loved one. It's my friend. It's my team. It's my political party. It's my country, right? You don't get to rejoice in that, you know, experience. It's pride. And again, this is not mudita. This is considered actually the near enemy of joy, since it can masquerade as mudita. But pride always involves propping up a sense of self, right? And so it's expanding a sense of self. Just check it out. I see some confused faces. So pride, it's helpful to remember that pride is what can lead to actual wars. Right? Right? This is my country. This is your country. I'm proud of this. You need to be proud of that, but we can't be equally, you know, proud. It's also really helpful as we explore mudita more to pay close attention to those mind states that are considered the very opposite of this unselfish joy. And so there's pride, but there's also what are considered, so that's the near enemy because it masquerades. And there's also what is considered the far enemies of joy. And the very first, if you might imagine, is envy. And the second one is greed, which is also a part of envy, right? So with envy, if you think about it, we're not only coveting what it, someone else is, has, but we're also in some way wanting to have it all for ourselves. We don't want to share, right? So or maybe we're fearful that there isn't enough to go around. It's that sense of, well, if they have it, then I can't have it too. Think about that whenever you're envious. They have it, so there's no way I can have that, right? There's a great example of this from a story I once read about a door-to-door salesman who said that for almost a full decade, he won Salesperson of the Year by perfecting one classic line, which was, "Let me show you something several of your neighbors said you couldn't afford." So there's envy and greed right there. So that's envy and greed. And a third far enemy of joy is often the result of these first two, which is, I'm not going to pronounce this right, I don't think, but it's Schadenfreude. And this is a German word that means taking pleasure in the misfortune of others. And the writer Anne Lamott, who knows Anne Lamott? Yeah, that's okay. So I adore her. And she once described how difficult it was for her to deal with the success of other writers, especially if they were friends of hers. And she said, "It can wreak just the tiniest bit of havoc with your self-esteem to find that you are hoping for small bad things to happen to this friend," she said. "For instance, for her head to blow up. So I really think she hit all three of those enemies of joy. There's actually a pop culture word that refers to when you are so envious of one of your friends that you almost can't stand it. And it's called frenvy. Frenvy. Unfortunately, social psychologists who've studied envy say that, quote, among the seven deadlies, it occupies a unique position. It is the only sin that is never fun. All the other ones are a little fun, right? Not so much this one. So isn't that true, though? It's not fun for you, and it's also not fun for the person who's experiencing it. And it's really, in truth, very harmful to the person who's on the receiving end of your envy or frenvy. And so, you know, have you ever been envied by someone? Anybody? Have you ever been envied by someone? Maybe a sibling or a, you know, family member or a coworker or something. You know, how does that feel? How does that feel to know that, right? Or, you know, you might consider, did you ever really want to share some kind of a joy with someone, but you held back because you thought that maybe they might be jealous? How did that feel to not, you know, because they're envious and you can't share your joy and get that sense of, you know, I want to share this. You know, maybe, for instance, you're expecting a baby and your friend can't have one, so you can't share that joy, or something like that, or you got a promotion, or whatever it was, you didn't share that. And it might be skillful means not to share that sometimes, but I want you to notice what it feels like, because that's what it feels like when you're offering your envy to someone. That's how the other person receives it. You know, it hurts. Or maybe you did share your joy, and the person who was listening didn't join you in that. That really hurts too. If there's great joy and you share it and the other person's like, whatever, or changes the subject, that's really hurtful. The singer and actress Bette Midler once said, the worst part of success is trying to find someone who's happy for you. Right? It's true. On the cover story of Tricycle magazine a few years ago, the author Joan Duncan Oliver wrote this about envy. However couched it might be, envy by its very nature is hostile. The word comes from the Latin invidere, to regard maliciously, to grudge. Unlike its cousin greed, envy doesn't just crave the object of its desire, it taints the whole project, begrudging others what they have and, when all else fails, devaluing and destroying the desired object. So in our practice, it's really important to remember that the person is not the object of your envy. That person is not the object of your hostility. The real object is the thing they have that you're envying, right? So when through your awareness practice you can take a closer look, it might help you to examine what you're wanting in your life more intimately, right? And so it might help you to remember to have a deep compassion for yourself for the wanting, because the wanting is in no way wrong. People ask me this a lot. Oh, but I'm wanting. Isn't wanting in Buddhism wrong? It's not that the wanting, the longing for something is wrong. We wouldn't get anything accomplished if we didn't have dreams and longing and wants. That's in no way wrong. You know? What causes us so much suffering is needing it to be a certain way. You know, the expectation of results, the needing it so much that you have bad behavior or you have tunnel vision and everything else gets shoved away, or I need that thing this way or I'm going to die, you know, or I'm not going to be, you know, your version of self and identity is caught up in it. You know, if I don't get this thing, then I'm a failure. Or whatever kind of identity you have caught up in it, right? That's what causes suffering. The wanting is in no way wrong. Anne Yulianov, the author of Cinderella and Her Sisters, The Envied and the Envying, suggests envy, so spoiling and injurious, can, if suffered consciously, point us toward the good that we thirst for. I read that again. Envy, so spoiling and injurious, can, if suffered consciously, point us toward the good that we thirst for. Right? So when you're caught up in envy, instead of getting caught up in hatred or aversion, or God, they have that, you know, and hating that person, see if you can check in on into what you most deeply want and offer yourself compassion for that. Or maybe take a closer look at it. I really want that, or some version of that. Right? And so once we've really seen this and examined it through our practice, it then becomes much easier for us to offer our mudita to the person that's right before us, because what we're doing is recognizing the suffering of our own conditioning. Our conditioning, our needs and wants, our conditioning, whatever that is causing us to have this aversion, envy towards this other person. It also helps to remember that we all suffer, all of us. Even those who seem to have something we want suffer, and especially those we don't like or those we feel deserve it in some way. There's a bumper sticker I saw once that helps me to remember this. And it simply said, mean people suffer. Mean people suffer. They do. I also like to think of the words of Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, who wrote, if we could read the secret history of our enemies, we should find in each man's life sorrow and suffering enough to disarm all hostility. It's true. So, a really important part of mudita practice involves remembering the first two Brahmaviharas, compassion and kindness, metta and karuna, and applying these not only towards yourself, but also towards all those who envy, and maybe even those who you despise. It's a practice, not easy. And when we work with our envy as well as our pride, it's also really helpful to remember the Buddha's teachings on how we meditate. So when we can see that we're suffering from thoughts of envy and pride, we can consciously abandon them. Remember not to water those roots. I see it. I'm thinking, I'm having these envious thoughts. Instead of chewing on it, munch, 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 right? We cogitate. So when we recognize it in the practice, we don't pour water on the roots, because that's, guess what? That's what we're practicing. You know, Thich Nhat Hanh says, whatever we're thinking, if we're thinking about hatred, guess what? That's what we're practicing. So we don't water the roots, right? And we abandon those and stop watering them and revving them up and indulging in all those juicy visions of Schadenfreude, you know, those can get really interesting. And just like all the other, you know, Brahmaviharas, mudita is something we can then actively cultivate by intentionally changing our thinking about this, you know, and also by mindfully looking for it. It's really fun to start looking for it and being on the watch for those times when people are experiencing joy in their lives or just joy in general. Being on the lookout for it. Anybody have a gratitude journal in here? Yeah, many of you. If you don't, it's a beautiful practice. So there's been a lot of studies around it, actually. Right at the end of the evening, you write down maybe 10 or 12 things that you're grateful for. It could be like really simple things like that beautiful butterfly or the sound of my pen on this paper. It could be anything. It doesn't have to be huge. But what it does is it trains the mind to look for joy, because our minds are generally greedy. And so once you start the practice during your day, you'll be like, oh, I can use that for my gratitude. You know, it's like collecting it. Oh, I got that. I got this for my journal. And it retrains the mind to look for it, to look for joy. So You know, we don't let it pass, the joy. We are conscious about cultivating it, just with all the other brahmaviharas. Ooh, that was joyful. And that was joyful. Ooh, and that person looks joyful. And they're beaming. Let me let that resonate in the heart. And we build on it, okay? So whenever we, like, hear distant laughter, for instance, we're asked to ride that joy, to catch some of it and feel connected to it. And once you start looking, you're going to be amazed at how much joy there is. Amazed. Just this breath is amazing. You know, Pat talks about the gift of each moment of life. This new day, every morning, he says, the gift that you've been given. Each breath is a gift. So it can get really, 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 you can be grateful for everything. And once you start doing it, you know, you'll be amazed. And as the Dalai Lama said, you can't really get too greedy with this one. You cannot get too greedy with collecting joy. Finally, as we continue to nurture and build on our practice of mudita, just like all the other brahmaviharas, it's said that this inner wellspring of joy, the more and more we build it, eventually becomes unlimited, unlimited joy. So this means not just limited to those we love. It becomes available and offered out to everyone and everything around us. In the Digha Nikaya, the Buddha tells us, "Hear, O monks," which means us, "hear, O monks, a disciple lets one's mind pervade one quarter of the world with thoughts of unselfish joy, and so the second, and so the third, and so the fourth, and thus the whole wide world, above, below, around, everywhere and equally, one continues to pervade with a heart of unselfish joy, abundant, grown great, measureless, without hostility or ill will." And that seems like a tall order, but I love to read that just as encouragement, that that's a possibility. Just to imagine it makes my heart happy. So to end, I want to offer you just a very short practice. Pat's going to offer us a longer practice on mudita tomorrow. But since you've all been sitting, I'm going to first ask you to just stand up and make your bodies happy. Bring some mudita to the body. And again, as I was offering in the groups today, a really good practice to find mudita is to have gratitude for your body, which means all your all the parts of your body. So your hands, when you're moving, your hands are touching something. Thank you, hands. Wow, look what they can do. You know, thank you, feet, for holding me up. Thank you. Start having gratitude. We're always so negative towards our bodies. If you start saying thank you to your body, that can really help with mudita practice. Joy. Okay. Everyone wants to do the standing? So I'm gonna invite you to sit because we'll come into meditation practice. And make yourself comfy. You don't have to be in a particular posture at all. If your body's hurting, you can sit with your legs out. Doesn't matter. It's going to be brief. So just for a moment, invite the body and mind to settle. Close the eyes. I'm going to invite you again to place a hand on the heart, or both hands, or one on the belly. Whatever feels good, breathe into the fingers. I'm going to invite you to repeat these words first to yourself and really see if you can, again, not use it as an incantation. Really feel it and believe it and wish this for yourself. May I be happy. May I be well. May I be free from fear. You might even add a slight smile to the mouth or the eyes. May I be happy. May I be well. May I be free from fear. Really let that resonate, your wish for yourself. May I be happy. May I be well. May I be free from fear. Keep it going. And if there's other words that are coming up for you that you'd like that are better than these, go ahead and use those. And I'm going to invite you very briefly to look kind of down at the ground. Open your eyes just very slightly. And I want you to move them over so that you can maybe see the feet or the hands or the body of the person to your left. And if there's nobody to your left, you might look at the person in front of you. And really get a sense of this person, maybe someone you've been sitting next to the whole time. And go ahead and close the eyes again. And now thinking of this being, this person next to you, see if you can offer them your care and kindness. Remembering that this person, just like yourself, suffers deeply in their own way and simply wishes to be happy. May you be happy. May you be well. May you be free from fear. May you be happy. May you be well. May you be free from fear. See what that does to your heart to offer this person your kindness and your well wishes for their happiness. And now I'm going to invite you to repeat this wish for the two of you, for both of you. May we both be happy. May we both be well. May we both be free from fear. May we both be happy. May we be well. May we be free from fear. Feeling that connection. And I'd like you now to extend that wish to all of us here in the room, including yourself. May we all be happy. May we all be well. May we all be free from fear. May we all be happy. May we all be well. May we all be free from fear. And now expanding this out limitlessly to all the people beyond all borders, all beings, those that fly in the sky, swim in the ocean, crawl on the earth, and are planted in the earth, all of us, including the earth. May we all be happy. May we all be well. May we all be free from fear. May we all be happy. May we all be well. May we all be free from fear. Continuing to let this wish resonate in the heart as you hear the bells. May we all be happy. May we all be well. May we all be free from fear.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.